we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. It's a Department of Corrections bill, and we are going to bypass the council's summary of this. So, Ms. Martin, the duties on you are especially onerous right now, so we'll call our first witness, Ginger Martin, to tell us about this bill. Thank you.
I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 189, which was pre-session filed by the governor at the request of the department. This bill revises several obsolete provisions in the statute that currently governs our inmate education programs. It changes that statute in three ways. The first is to abolish a defunct advisory committee, which was set up when this law was passed initially. The law created the functional literacy program and directed us to use an advisory committee to help develop and design that program. That committee met, it accomplished its task, and is no longer meeting. We in our education department. The administrator of our education department is a member of the Oregon Council of Adult Basic Skills Development, and that group functions as our advisory committee now. In addition, we have a number of specialized advisory committees for our technical programs, and we call together ad hoc groups to advise us on specific aspects of our education program as needed. The second change is that we'd like to clearly establish the GED as one of the goals of the department's education program. Currently, the statute clearly requires us to serve inmates who test below the eighth grade level on a literacy test, but the statute doesn't specifically mention those who come to us without a high school credential. We know this is very important for success after prison, and we'd like for the statute to make it clear that this is one of the purposes of the inmate education program. And thirdly, we'd like to authorize some flexibility in the hours of education and the literacy testing method as prescribed. The statute currently says that we must provide an hour and a half of education 5 days a week. This statute was passed before Measure 17, and now we're balancing our requirement to have inmates work full-time and also attend education, and we would find it to be easier to sort of manage all of those responsibilities with less prescription in the statute. In addition, the statute prescribes a particular literacy test, and while that's still the kind of state-of-the-art test, we'd like the statute to allow us to use whatever is approved by the Adult Basic Skills Program of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development that will allow us to stay current with whatever the particular state-of-the-art test is, as it may change over time. These changes don't change or affect the numbers of inmates that are served in our program and don't have an impact on cost, but they do bring the statute into alignment with best practices for adult education, and so we respectfully request that you send Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I especially was gratified to see abolishing a defunct committee. I don't think we abolish enough committees in this system. So. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189 and open a work session on Senate Bill 189. Senator Prezanski.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Prezanski has moved Senate Bill 189 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Would either of you like to carry it?
I'll take it if you want me
to. Okay, Senator Prezanski, I'll take that. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 190. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 190 extends to all employees of the Department of Corrections the right to seek testing of body fluids when an employee comes in contact with the body fluids of another person while in the performance of his or her official duties, effective upon passage.
Okay. We have signed up for this Stan Cherniak and Patrick Vance from DOC. Did you two want to come up together?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome.
Welcome.
Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Stan Zerniak. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations, and we appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you about this bill that was filed by Governor Kulongoski at the request of the department. By the very nature of our work, corrections employees sometimes risk their lives in the performance of their duties. One of the most significant risks that our employees face is the exposure to bodily fluids from inmates. And this can take the form of being spit at, having bodily fluids thrown at them. It can take the form of receiving bodily fluids through breaking up fights or being assaulted. Or in the case of some of our medical providers, this can happen when a nurse pricks herself with a needle that has been used to either do an injection or to take a blood sample. When this occurs, the inmate may deny consent to being tested for bloodborne pathogens, including HIV, hepatitis B or C, and this prevents the employee from knowing whether he or she should seek prophylactic treatment for exposure to a possibly life-threatening disease. Current statutes permit correctional officers and licensed health care providers and some other staff to petition the court to compel an inmate to be tested in such a situation. We had such a situation just within the last 2 weeks. Typically, inmates have given consent prior to this, but in the case where an inmate refuses consent, some staff do not have that recourse to petition the court to get have the inmate tested. And some of the staff that are included in that would be maintenance staff, some of your counselors, and some of your office staff that work inside the prisons. And I just want to give you some idea of the nature of this problem in terms of our past history. In the 2003-2005 biennium, there were 42 incidents of exposure. 27 were to correctional officers and 15 were to health care services staff. Since July 1st of 2005, there have been 56 incidents of exposure. 44 were to correctional officers and 12 to non-correctional officer series. And one of those included a physical plant staff, which is a maintenance staff, and one of those included a hearings officer that was conducting a disciplinary hearing. Fortunately, when requested, most inmates do, in fact, as I indicated earlier, consent to testing, but this is not compulsory. Senate Bill 190 would expand the rights for testing and disclosure to every employee who is exposed to inmate bodily fluids in the course of his or her official duties. We believe this expansion of coverage is necessary to protect the health and safety of our entire workforce, ensuring that each employee exposed to inmate bodily fluids has the right to learn information necessary to determine if further medical testing is necessary. The Department of Corrections respectfully requests you that you send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Did you want to testify, Mr. Vance, before we take questions? Or
Chair Burdick, I invited Mr. Vance to come up here just in case there are any medical-type questions that I might not be able to answer.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Basically, what this would do is just no matter who gets afflicted by one of these attacks of bodily fluid or accidental exposure, this wouldn't just limit the right to have the inmate tested to health care workers and correctional officers.
That is correct, Chair Burdick.
And there are other employees who come into contact with the prisoners and are at risk of doing this.
That is correct, Chair Burdick, particularly our counselors, our food service workers, our maintenance staff, and in the case of a hearing officer recently who did, in fact, receive bodily fluids from an inmate, that's always a possibility.
Mm-hmm. And in the past, have you had a case where an inmate refused and they were not able to get testing of that inmate?
Chair Burdick, that just occurred within the last 2 weeks. We did have a correctional officer who, in fact, had to compel that we had to go to court to get a court order to have this inmate tested.
But have you had a case where a non-correctional officer, a non-healthcare worker has been exposed and they would have this, I understand under current law, they would have no remedy if the inmate refused?
That is correct, Chair Burdick. We did have a maintenance worker and a hearings officer who technically are not covered by the statute. But the inmate did consent to the test.
Okay. All right.
So in those cases.
Okay. So this is just to stop, you know, the possibility of future incidents where the...
That's right, Chair Burdick.
...where the inmate does not consent. Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much, both of you. And now I will call Brian DeLashmet and Mary Botkin.
I'll attempt to make this very quick. Brian DeLashmet, I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees and also the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Actually, Chair Burdick, I can shed a little bit of a light on the history of this. Actually, the original form of this bill that's been in statute, I think, four sessions now. They all kind of run together. But actually was at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, because what we found was before the statute, if a police officer was exposed in the street, either through a scuffle, an accident, or whatever, the only process that they had was a very extended process in which you had to go basically in front of the court. All parties got to come in, and by the time you actually found out or were able to get an order to have the blood drawn, you may be a month, 2 months, 3 months down the road, in which case you really had to take the preventive prophylactic precautions up front before you even knew whether or not the exposure was a problem. And so they had asked me to introduce the original bill. It's in here. We're strongly supportive of this expansion. I think it makes logical sense. At the time the original bill was in, I think we were talking or thinking in terms of just public safety officers having this exposure. But I think this, in fact, is a good cleanup.
Thank you. Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, here today representing AFSCME. We represent about 2,500 to 3,000 corrections employees around the state of Oregon. And the case to which Mr. Zerniak was referring to was a case of an assault that occurred late last week to one of our officers at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. And in fact, this last weekend, Senator Nelson had a meeting with all of the institutions in his area about this incident and the problems that have arisen as a result of it. And the inmate did refuse a blood test. And we joined with the Department of Corrections with our in-house legal counsel and filed a court order compelling the inmate to be tested. The problem that arises when an inmate refuses to be tested is that the officer or the exposed employee must start treatment immediately. And the treatment for exposure can be uncomfortable and debilitating for the officer involved. We strongly support the expansion that the bill intends to cover all employees. The only question that we have, and we're not particularly interested in slowing the bill down, is in our assault bills we have included volunteers and contractors as well. Just so that everybody who is on the inside of an institution doing legitimate work are covered by the same statutes and the same protections. And if it's the committee's desire to move the bill today, we would encourage you to go ahead and move the bill. And, Madam Chair, if you don't have a problem with it, what we'd like to do is work with corrections and find out if we should amend it over in the House side to include all those folks who are within the secure perimeter of the institution and may suffer a similar exposure, as we have with our assault language, which included volunteers and contractors. Because you do have volunteers who come into the institution to do work with the inmates, and you have contractors who are regularly inside the institution. But again, I don't want the bill to slow down as a result of that change.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruszynski.
We're not moving bills, from my understanding, until like March 5th.
Yes.
And we're just the third week into the, I mean, it seems like we're on such an accelerated rate. We, I think we have enough time. I mean,
yeah. Well, we are accelerated. Yeah, it's really a hard judgment. I'll go with the will of the committee because I think you raise a very good point. And my only hesitation here is that it's my understanding that Legislative Council is not going to be doing amendments until it finishes up with all its bills, which means a couple, 3 weeks. So I'm thinking it might, for the good of the order, because it's such a logical thing, and since it's the sense of this committee that I see a lot of head nods about this, it certainly wouldn't have trouble if it came back here like that. I think my inclination would be to send it along its way, because I doubt that we could get those amendments for another month.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm wondering, I mean, if we're looking at expediting process, sending the bill we know needs amendments to the House, and then they amend it, and then they send it back, and especially as we get towards the end, strange things can happen. I've always preferred to send, if we know what needs to be done to clean up a measure, I've always preferred to clean it up and send something clean to the other chamber.
Well, maybe we could have our counsel, we could put it off today, certainly, and we could have our counsel check with Legislative Council and see what our chances of getting an amendment timely.
I can do that, Madam Chair.
We're, you know, with the annual session and with the tight timelines, we're just in a different environment than we've been in
like
before,
with
a very compressed bill introduction deadline, which is really the.
Madam Chair, again, Mary Bodkin. I apologize. I really did not intend to slow this bill down.
Well, and
without
I,
cause.
You know, that's a legitimate thing. But we're here to produce good laws, and frankly, when I saw this bill, I thought, you know, I wondered whether it should be expanded to include visitors. So. Let's let it go for a few days and scope it out and see what we can come up with.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I see the attorney for the Department of Corrections in the audience, Jeff Valkenberg, and I'm sure if I was sat down with him, we could come up with some language that not technically in LC form, but would make their job a lot easier. And getting amendments back right now depends on the drafter, depending on what workload they have ahead in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we get the language pretty close, it would definitely speed the process up.
Well, I think I would feel more comfortable, and I know that other members of the committee would feel more comfortable if we sent the best possible product out. So do go ahead and get the volunteers in, get the contractors in, and the visitors, unless there's a problem with visitors. Okay. Any other questions, comments from the committee? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 190 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 260. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 260 requires a guardian to obtain medical confirmation of medical condition that would allow the withholding of food or water before doing so from a person under the protection of the guardian. Applies to guardianships commenced before or after the effective date of the measure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill from last session and Senate Bill 248.
Oh. Senate Bill 248 from last session?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. I had forgotten that number.
And, Madam Chair, could we get a detail about what happened to Senate Bill 248 last session?
It passed this committee with some opposition. It passed the Senate floor, and it died in the House.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, now we will have Bill Lynch, and do you want to come up with Bob Junior? Okay. Is Tina Kitchen in the screen?
Tina, which
one is that? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I see many faces that I saw this morning in a hearing. And you'll recognize one of the pieces of paper that I handed out this morning without the typographical errors, I hope. The first one piece of paper I handed out was just an introduction to you of who the Oregon Advocacy Center is, and I know that most of the faces I see here today have worked with us in the past, and so I'm not going to spend time with that. But since you've been so kind as to schedule a number of our bills today, I thought that having an understanding of what our organization does might help to explain why we've gotten involved in the four different matters that you're going to hear today. Moving to Senate Bill 260. This is a matter that's a little bit hard to explain because it involves the intersection of two large statutory groups in the ORS, and one is the guardianship law, and one is our laws governing end-of-life decision-making. In the end-of-life decision-making portion of the law, there is a provision that specifically deals with consent to remove artificial nutrition and hydration, and sets forth, basically it says that there is a presumption in the law that a person agrees to receive artificial nutrition, hydration, that is tube feeding. And then there's certain exceptions under which that presumption can be overcome. And one is that if a person has indicated clearly in the past that they don't want tube feeding, and then there's a few medical criteria, one being that the person is in an end-of-life type of situation. One is that providing the tube feeding would cause intractable pain and be medically impracticable. And one that a person is essentially in late-stage Alzheimer's. There is another exception written into that statute that says if a person has an appointed health care representative, then that health care representative can make the decision. When read together with the guardianship law, the effect of that is that if a person has been appointed a legal guardian, that the guardian has the authority to give consent to the removal of artificial nutrition, hydration at any time under any circumstances, and also has protection from liability for that decision. This is the only group of people in the state who do not have the protection of the presumption that they want tube feeding. Because of the appointment of a guardian. The effect of passing Senate Bill 260 would be that a guardian would also have to take into account the exceptions that are presently in the law for every other adult, which means that a guardian would have authority to give consent for removal of tube feeding if a person was in 6 months of end of life as a result of a terminal illness, if providing the tube feeding would create intractable pain and suffering and be medically impracticable, or the person is in a late stage Alzheimer's type situation. Those standards would apply to folks who have guardians as well as those who don't. And that would be the effect of the statute. And the reason that we're here bringing this to you is that our office, One of the purposes of our organization is to respond to complaints of abuse or neglect of people with disabilities. For people who suffer from severe disabilities, such as mental retardation, those individuals may have health problems and may end up in situations where they are receiving tube feeding as a result of their medical situation, or they may have been on tube feeding all their lives. That just may be a part of their daily living. And circumstances have come up in which people have gone into some sort of a health crisis, and there's been allegations made by care providers that the guardian involved was agreeing to removal of tube feeding, even though that individual was not in an end-of-life situation, that they were merely experiencing a health crisis of some sort. And the allegation was that the family was of the view that the disabled individual's life was, shall we say, not of the value that we might ascribe to a person without a disability, and that nature should take its course under those circumstances. These are extremely heart-wrenching, difficult situations, and there's very little guidance when there's a guardian appointed as to what to do. Our sense is that if the legal structure that this body worked for enormous amount of hearings, if you recall back in the 90s, to put together in terms of setting some standards in this area, if this was applied to guardians, then that would give us a solid structure for that type of decision making. And that's why we bring that to you today.
Thank you. So to recap, what you're saying is now the guardian really doesn't have enough guidance to guide their decision on whether to disconnect, but the guardian still has the authority to disconnect the person?
Right now, the law allows the guardian completely open field in terms of making this decision without any type of limitation whatsoever. Of course, that decision has to be made in league with the medical provider.
Right.
But again, there is no there are no bounds that apply. It's just really a question of the agreement between the provider and the guardian as to what steps to take.
Okay, so this would they would have to fulfill the criteria that are set out in this bill in order to reach the decision to.
That's what we're proposing.
And I'm assuming if the person, you said if the person is designated that they don't want, extraordinary measures taken, that's a consideration. But what if the person has designated that they do want extraordinary measures? Then is a guardian bound by that?
Senator Burdick, again, the same presumptions that apply to everybody else in society would apply to people with guardians, so that that if they had executed an advance care directive in which their wishes were set forth, then those would need to be honored. If there is some question about their whether that's the case or not, that might be brought to the guardianship court if one wanted to contest it in order to determine whether the facts supported that conclusion or not. But again, the person with the guardian would have the same presumption as everyone else in society that they had agreed, unless there was that indication they had stated clearly that they didn't want it or one of the medical exceptions applies.
Okay. Questions? Counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Jundiff, the way I read the statute now, there's a presumption that the protected person has consented to artificial administration of food and water. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, committee counsel, that there's a presumption that everyone has, so it's not that would also apply to protected.
That provision would apply to a guardian.
There is a specific exception that guardians fall into. Mm-hmm. So that presumption would not apply if a guardian has been appointed. So right now and that's sub B that allows an exception when there is an appointed healthcare representative. Guardian is officially an appointed healthcare representative, and as such, that eliminates the need for it reverses the presumption. In other words, there is no presumption.
Now, that's current law.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, other appointed healthcare representatives, all of the other appointed healthcare representatives are representatives who've been appointed by the individual themselves. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I appoint my wife to be my healthcare representative and give her instructions, then that presumption I would be giving her the authority to make that decision, and that would overcome the presumption. But in a guardian situation, I don't get to direct that in any way as the person who's affected. It's a court has appointed a person, and they can then move ahead without any sense of what I would have wanted to do or not wanted to do. So there's a disconnect between the person's wishes, either their specific wishes in terms of whether they want tube feeding or not, or their specific wishes in terms of giving another person the authority to make those very delicate, crucial decisions in their lives. A guardian is the only situation in which there's someone who can waive the presumption, who is not doing so at the direction of the person who might have the tube feeding removed.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dunlap, I voted against this bill last session. I don't even remember the bill last session, but I do know I voted against it because we just checked the record. And I know it passed this committee and went to the House. And my question was, did this have a hearing in the House? And if so, what was the discussion?
Senator Burdick, Senator Cruz, it did not have a hearing in the House. The bill was held up by the Speaker, it never surfaced.
Madam Chair, one might assume that the relative juxtaposition, time-wise, to Scheibel might have had an impact on this. So.
That's the understanding that I had, Senator Cruz, even though this has absolutely nothing to do with the circumstances of the Terry
Scheibel. And this building perception seems to be everything. So.
Yeah. So that was a very wound-up time in this whole country. Senator Walker, did you have a question?
Well, I remember this bill, and I just thought, wow, this makes so much sense, because shouldn't someone who's incapacitated and that's represented by a guardian, there should be some checks and balances here. The guardian shouldn't be able to just help you die without getting someone else to confirm that and making that decision. I don't think a guardian is capable of making that decision unless you have given written instructions beforehand, which, you know, I have my written instructions about that, but a lot of people don't. So this just makes so much sense, and I'm glad you brought it back forward to the legislature, because I think there needs to be protection for these people who are under the care of a guardian. So,
and
that was a comment, and I could say, don't you agree? Make it a question. But
thank you, Senator Walker. And just for the record, is this identical to the version we sent out of our committee last session?
Yes, Chair Gordon.
Okay, because I remember we spent a lot of time on this bill last session, had a lot of good discussion. Any other questions from this side?
We were talking about the potential after Senator Walker brought up the guardian issue. If the guardian somehow had some type of financial, interest in the sense of a life insurance or something like that, in the decision that's made, it seems like you would want some type of a check and balance.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, a good question for me right now is, I assume that a beneficiary can also be a guardian?
Is that
true?
That is my understanding.
further question?
Senator Barr, please.
I guess I'm just trying to, and I also voted against this bill last session, and I don't even remember the bill now, so that's what I'm trying to figure that. But when it says the guardian may consent, and the new language being proposed on subsection 3, section 1, if the guardian was to get that medical opinion, and does this language anyway, shape, or form, or even imply that if the doctor says that, none of these things or all these things are, potentially the case, would the guardian feel they would have to withdraw support? I mean, is that implied in any way, shape, or form?
Senator Burick, Senator Beyer, I don't believe so. The medical decision making is always takes two to tango in a medical decision. It takes the physician and the decision maker. All of this bill does is it places restrictions on the decision maker, and it says that you can make this decision, but only in certain circumstances. But within those circumstances, you get to decide, say yes or no. It doesn't in any way try to tilt the playing field one way or the other in terms of which decision to make.
Follow-up? And you're probably not the right person to ask this question, but in the case of insurance, if the medical provider says that, you know, within 6 months of life, blah, 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 are there any insurance implications then that the insurance company would be able to say, you pull the plug, you pull the tube, or we're not going to cover that person anymore?
Senator Burke, Senator Beyer, I am not aware of any health insurance issues personally. Someone else might be more appropriate, but I can tell you that since this is the standard that presently applies to all Oregonians except people with guardians, whatever issue may be there is there as we speak, and this isn't designed to address that.
I can't imagine, Senator Beyer, that that would not be illegal for an insurance company to come in and basically threaten someone like that. If you find that it is, please bring it to my attention. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much. Did you want to testify as well?
Yes, please. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Bill Lynch, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. The coalition is made up of about 25 organizations that represent people with developmental disabilities, families, providers, advocates, and others. And I'm here on their behalf to lend support to Senate Bill 260. Individuals with disabilities are often reminded that they're, in the eyes of many, second-class citizens. And recently, I'm sure you've seen articles about the story out of Seattle, the child who's received medical treatments to permanently limit her growth and physical development so that her family could continue to care for her in the home. We also had a recent issue in the Portland area, the Education Service District board member who made disparaging remarks about children that receive services from his program. And it's in the context of these kind of devaluing and discriminatory behaviors that we support this bill. In recent years in Oregon, Mr. Joondeff referenced, there have been several situations, this is not just theoretical, several situations that have raised concern about the power of a guardian to withhold or withdraw nutrition and hydration for protected persons. We believe people with disabilities, all protected persons, should have the same protections in this life or death matter as any other person. And we believe that this legislation will assure the rights of protected individuals and provide a legal process for guardians who are confronted with making these very serious decisions. So we do support this legislation.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Now we will hear from Tina Kitchen. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Tina Kitchen. I am the medical director for Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I'm also here in support of this bill. We have been with Oregon Advocacy Center on some of these situations, and we would like some clarification in the statute about what the authority for the guardian really is.
Thank you.
And at that, I'll keep it very short.
Thank you. We have your written testimony for the record. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 260, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 260 and give Senator Beyer the option to make a motion, but if you choose not to, then you don't have to.
Madam Chair, I would agree that, you know, to move this bill to the floor. I would also put on the record that, as I don't remember the bill or the issues that surrounded it last session and to the reasons why I voted against it, I would, you know, if I find out what that is and there's, I have an objection to it, I'll stand up on the floor of the House, or the floor of the Senate, and say so and vote against it then.
Appreciate it. Are you moving the bill, Senator Beyer, or
Madam
would you
Chair,
prefer?
Yeah, I'll move the bill, but okay. Please don't make me carry it.
You will not carry the bill, Senator Beyer. Senator Beyer has moved the Senate Bill 260 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and a notation that he may change his opinion later. So this motion to move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation is before us. Is there any discussion?
This, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer needs me to tell him what he was thinking about this bill last session. If he said it on the record, I can order my notes back from archives and tell him. But
we have such a resource on this committee, Senator Beyer. You should take her up on it. I almost remember. I just can't quite get there. Is there any other discussion? Are there any objections to this bill?
No.
Okay. Without objection, Senate Bill 260 goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I will carry this bill. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 263. Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 264.
263.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Requires a hospital resident care facility or adult foster care facility providing mental health or developmental disability services to report within 2 business days from the death of a person receiving services to the organization designated to protect the rights of disabled individuals in Oregon. That's the Oregon Advocacy Center. They're appointed under federal regulation. The report must contain the name and age of the person, the name and addresses of the individuals, programs, or facilities responsible for the person's care, including guardians, conservators, and health care representatives, and the date, time, and place, and cause of death.
Okay. Mr. June Deff?
Madam Chair, while he's coming up, could I ask the council a question?
Sure.
Thank you. In the background, it says currently a hospital residence care facility or adult foster care. Mental health or development services does not have to report one of the persons receiving the services has died. By that, do you mean he does not have to report to the advocacy center or to anyone?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my assumption it was to the advocacy center, but that's what I assume the purpose of the bill is for. My assumption is that they would have to report to the police, I mean, in that regard.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Okay. It seems that this background says they don't have to report it to anyone. And I was curious to know if you knew that was the case or not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, this is my preliminary step or something. Okay.
And maybe you can shed some light on that, Mr. Junius, in your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Bob Junius from Oregon Advocacy Center. In order to understand where we're coming from this bill, I think it's important to understand one of our roles. And we are, as I spoke a little bit earlier, we are creatures of federal law, even though we are a nonprofit, and that federal law directs us to investigate complaints and allegations of abuse and neglect of people with disabilities. We have prioritized over the years, as have our federal funders, investigations of death and serious incidents involving serious injuries to folks with disabilities. However, we have no authority to receive information about the death of those individuals in care settings in Oregon, and as you might expect, that creates a little bit of an impediment for us in terms of fulfilling the role that was slated for us in those federal statutes. In addition, as I will talk a little bit more later, is that one area that has been a particular concern by the federal government in recent years and also in this state has been the use of mechanical physical restraints on people with mental illness, particularly in isolation of people with mental illness in care settings. And there's been an effort nationally to improve the rights of people who are subjected to those types of interventions and to assure that, when they are used, that they're used in a safe manner that can protect both that person, staff, and be encouraging of their treatment rather than as a detriment to that. All of that having been said, after discussions with the Department of Human Services, I've become convinced that the way that we wrote this bill might actually be counterproductive because it may place a burden on providers that would be confusing and duplicative for them. And representatives of DHS have indicated that they would be willing to sit down with me both to understand all of the reports that are required already by Department of Human Services in these areas and how that information can get through to our organization in a manner that will not result in there being it being overly burdensome to the providers and duplicative for them. And frankly, I believe that that serves our interests as well, is because we don't have an interest in just getting a big pile of paper that's not going to get us the information we need, but we want to make sure that we're able to get the serious information about the serious incidences so that we can perform our oversight function. And that's what we intend to do. And so I guess what I'm asking this committee to do at this point would be to hear from the witnesses, but encourage us, as I said, to sit down to make some changes to the language in the bill so that it can achieve the goal we want to without without creating unnecessary paperwork or expense for the people whose job it is to provide the services to the folks we also want to serve.
Okay, and Mr. June, if while you're doing that, you'll address the perhaps lack of clarity that Senator Beyer was referring to in his comments.
And Senator Burdick, frankly, this is an area that I haven't gotten to the bottom of. I understand that there are some reporting requirements in terms of deaths, but it depends upon the service system involved. And as you know, there's multiple service systems. So we have a mental health service system and a developmental disability service system and a senior and disabled service system. And then there's various levels of foster care and nursing homes and residential treatment facilities and state hospitals. And there's just a whole bunch of players in here. And they have different requirements, as I understand it, in terms of reporting.
I just think the point is that if you're changing a requirement, you just need to be very clear about how far it goes and where it applies.
Exactly.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my it's a similar question in Section 3, Sub 2, and any injury requiring medical care is really, really broad. I think what you're after is any injury resulting from the restraint. I'm assuming that, but any injury, I cut my finger, I have a Band-Aid, is that medical care? Some would say that it is. So that section there is incredibly vague, and I would think you should say what you're after there. But that's just a suggestion.
And Senator Cruz, that's it's exactly what we want to do.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz has quite an impressive background in health care, so Senator Cruz, may I offer your assistance to, as they work their way through? He would be a good person to run by your discussions and agreements. before it comes back. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Nick Morris, Mike Morris. Somebody with bad handwriting, Morris.
No, Madam Chair. Someone with bad eyesight.
Oh, Senator Walker, you're so harsh.
Be kind to our witnesses.
And members of the committee, and for those of you who can't read my name on the chart, my name is Mike Morris. I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Addictions Mental Health Division of the Department of Human Services, and I will be brief in my comments. We are concerned about the bill as it's currently written for some of the ambiguities been raised already, and just we currently have a variety of reporting mechanisms, and this would create another layer, and we just want to be able to make sure that the reporting requirements coordinate with each other and don't create undue confusion or hardship as far as our providers providing the services. And we are very willing to work with Oregon Advocacy Center. Ideally, if we could work on an administrative fix for this and work out processes to get the information they are wanting, that'd be ideal. So, thank you.
That's very nice. And again, include Senator Cruz in the discussion since he's our resident health care expert. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I would also suggest that while we're looking at that, if we can discover streamlining potentials, it would be wonderful.
Okay, just remember, this session is not really long. So. Not yet. Okay, thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
Oh, Madam Chair, only that I would agree that your handwriting is bad, sir.
Senator Walker was very kind to put that on the record at your expense. My apologies on behalf of both of us. Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 263 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 264.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 264 defines an adult for the purposes of reporting abuse of a developmentally disabled person as a person 18 years of age or older with a developmental disability. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the current definition includes the phrase who is receiving services from a community program or facility, and the bill drops that phrase as it relates to disabled persons, but not mentally ill persons.
Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. Jundeff, you're back again. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam
You have
Chair.
Very good handwriting, by the way.
Thank you very much. I thought it would be proud. I'm Bob Jundeff from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Senate Bill 264 is another bill that's trying to address a little gap that exists right now in terms of our protective service system for people with developmental disabilities. As you know, Oregon has a number of mandatory abuse reporting and investigation statutory schemes. One is for children, and one is for seniors, one is for nursing home residents, and then there is one that covers people who receive services in the mental health system and people who receive services in the developmental disabilities system. That final one is the area that we're addressing in this bill. One of the things that makes the system for people with mental illness and developmental disabilities a little different is that eligibility for reporting and investigation and protective services, that is services designed to get a person out of a dangerous situation, is that those individuals have to be in service from a state-funded service, whereas, for example, children or elders are eligible by virtue of their age and considered to be more vulnerable. But in this area, the investigation is tied to being a part of the service system. What we have found out most recently in the last year with a very serious case, but we've had other cases of this kind in which there is an adult person with developmental disabilities, most likely mental retardation or autism, who lives in a family their family of origin that has, where there's some question of abuse or neglect. And when the when questions are raised about this by the service provider, the response of the family is to remove the person from services. And when that happens, then any authority that agency has to investigate is eliminated. And if they don't have enough information to substantiate a police complaint, then really that's the end of any authority by public agencies. In the situation that happened most recently, there was an adult woman who was in her family. This scenario I just outlined occurred. There was concerns that she was significantly neglected, and there were at least suspicion that she might be the victim of sexual assault, but there was no hard proof or evidence of that. And as I understand it, both the local and the state offices for protective services were told by their legal counsel that there was no authority to intervene in the situation. We were asked to play a part because a family member in that circumstance was a legal guardian, and we filed a motion in the local circuit court asking that the guardianship be changed so that we could have a new guardian appointed who would then have the authority to remove this individual from the family in order to have a medical examination and examine her condition, which in fact in this case did happen. And while they did not uncover any physical evidence of sexual abuse, there was significant indication that this young woman had been neglected. And so she has not been returned to that family environment. What we're seeking through this bill was to give state and local agencies the authority to intervene in these types of situations. Again, in discussions with DHS, they've raised some concerns that, frankly, we hadn't even thought about that have, from my perspective, have to do with how the various bureaucracies that are involved in protective services work with each other and share responsibilities, and they've suggested some language that would accomplish our goal, which would require an amendment to the bill, and we have no opposition to that.
Okay, I noticed in this bill that developmental disability is not defined in this bill. Does it have a definition? I assume it has a definition elsewhere in the statute.
Yes.
And this would refer back to that.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, so you want to work on an amendment and come back sooner the better, obviously.
That's fine, sure.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have anybody else signed up for this? I think we do. Where is my sign-up sheet? Mary Lee. Mary Lee.
I have a handwriting name.
Welcome, Mary Lee.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Mary Lee Fay, and I work with the Department of Human Services, Seniors, and People with Disabilities. And I'm here to provide testimony on Senate Bill 264. As Mr. Drundeff laid out the issues of needing to have authority to have the Community Developmental Disabilities Program be involved in protective services for individuals with developmental disabilities not in service, we are in agreement that we need that authority. But as he indicated, there were some issues with how the bill was written that might make things a little more confusing. For people with developmental disabilities, that is determined after they have come to a program, a county office, and the determination is made there.
Right now, if someone is unknown to our system and there is a protective service need, it would be the seniors and agency for persons with physical disabilities who would do an investigation. We're fearful that if we don't do some more descriptive language on who would be eligible, we'd actually have our agencies stop and kind of wonder who is supposed to be responsible, letting time go on and people not doing the investigations that need to be investigated. So you'll see that we did make some suggested language changes to have it be a person who is currently receiving services from community program or was previously determined as an adult to be eligible for services by community program. That will make it clear to our counties and our area agencies on aging what the responsibilities they have and who they should be involved with. The other item that Mr. Junduff referred to in giving a description of a case that was problematic for us to get involved with promptly may not yet be resolved even with this language change. And it's the authority for the department to have protective orders so that we can indeed go into homes where there are adults with developmental disabilities or other adults living in the care of a family member, and we are not able to intervene in those cases without protective order situations. In the case that Mr. Junduff talked about, actually having to go in and apply for guardianship was the only access we had, and it added in the neighborhood of 30 to 60 days in resolving a case that should have been acted on sooner. So we would like the ability to work with Mr. Junduff on also being able to include that language and that capacity in this.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think one of the advantages of what you're trying to do here is you certainly wouldn't want to have any encouragement for people to take people out of services that are benefiting them. Senator Cruz, did you have
a... I think it's she brought up some interesting points, sir.
Senator Byers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said when you were talking about the case Mr. Junduff brought up was that you wanted to be able to have the authority to go into a home with adults with disabilities or other adults. And what
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, it could also be individuals who are seniors. In seniors and people with disabilities, for example, there may be somebody who has dementia. Living with a caregiver where the authority to do a protective order, meaning that we need to go in and remove the individual as a result of some allegations, we're limited to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would just be like to caution you or whoever's working on the bill to not attempt to make it too broad, to allow too much, because I mean, I could see myself mm-hmm. falling off a bill like this very rapidly mm-hmm. if it gives you the right to do on minor complaints or anything else, go out and take people out of their homes just because they happen to be a senior or something like that. So I guess I'd advise
Madam
to keep
Chair,
the
Senator
scope of the bill very narrow.
Yes.
And I assume that's... Hmm?
Yes,
you're not intending
we would. It's in very limited. These cases are fortunately very rare, but when they do occur, the ability to be responsive is a very important feature.
Well, we'll be looking for very narrow language on this. Thank you very much. Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 264 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 265. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 265, pursuant to rule, requires the Department of Human Services the conditions of licensing to require the facility providing mental health services report quarterly the number of incidents involving the use of restraints or seclusion of patients.
Mr. Junduff.
Madam Chair, it's good to see you again.
I'm
Bob Junduff from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and this final bill that's on our docket today brings us back to a topic I spoke of a little bit earlier, which has to do with the use of seclusion and restraint in mental health treatment environments. Over the past number of years, I've worked with a variety of individuals, both doctors, other mental health professionals, administrators, and consumers and families who have been working together to create encouragement and support for decreasing the use of seclusion and restraint in the mental health environment. And I think I can speak accurately when I say that the trend nationally and in the profession is to work for ways to create more therapeutic environments that are based that seek to decrease the need for these types of interventions because they're both counterproductive in terms of treatment for individuals in many cases, and also that they're dangerous, that in the course of applying physical restraints that both the individual and the personnel can be injured. And so this generally viewed as a good thing. One thing particularly for advocates' families has been difficult has been to get a sense of the amount of usage of these interventions in facilities that are licensed to do them or use them. And then we're speaking specifically, the concern is specifically in mental health treatment, not in the area of developmental disabilities, although that's another issue, but not one that we're here to address today, or nursing homes or those types of care settings. But what we're primarily interested in is their use in psychiatric facilities. And the idea was really to make sure that data could be gathered so that there'd be able to get a sense of how often these interventions are used in different facilities, compiled on a quarterly basis, so that there would be both incentive from the facility side to encourage each other to be doing well in this area, and also for people who may be using those services to know about the use and to act as an aid in advocacy. One other thing I would mention, at least in my own experience, is that I believe that there tends to be more use of these types of interventions when the staffing is less, you know, or less well trained. And so, in a sense, its usage is a bellwether for how well that facility is working. Now, again, this is my mantra, I'm afraid, on these last three bills, is that the way that this particular bill is written may have unintended consequences in terms of its breadth. Talking with representatives from the Department of Human Services about how we could narrow that language so that there was no misunderstanding in terms of what it's trying to get at and who it's supposed to cover. And again, I'm very willing to do that because our intention here is not to, again, create unnecessary paperwork or reports that are not getting at what we are trying to get at, but we want. And so we stand ready to work on language to, in fact, do that.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because when I saw restraint and I saw seclusion, you know, with restraint, I'd want definite, very clear definitions of what restraint means. And, I assume you're talking about artificial, not just somebody holding somebody's arms down for a moment, but some kind of physical, some kind of more extensive restraint. And I'll leave that to the experts. But also seclusion, I think, needs to have some kind of time element or some kind of parameters around it so people understand what seclusion is.
Madam Chair, I also think that if we're talking about psych units, that this is information that's already being recorded somewhere, so it may just be a matter of aligning reports. These are incident reports, so it should be information that's available. So to create a whole new report if it's already part of another document. So that's what needs to be looked at.
Well, we have DHS, Mike Morris with the perfect handwriting, which is now perfect, signed up. So maybe we'll get some more elucidation from him. But before we call him, are there any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, if I might respond to one thing you said. While your characterization of restraint, I think, is accurate for adults, when we get into children's mental health, it becomes a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. And there are very specific rules from CMS on the use of restraint in children's mm-hmm. mental health, and there's some debate over them. And I believe that is an area that is particularly sensitive and worthy of data collection. And again, there are mechanisms for reporting of some of that data. I think what we're particularly interested in is that it's compiled and available openly for review. So that's one of the things we want to work on.
Madam Chair, I think the other thing he's relating to are there, in juvenile at least, there's a specific type of holds that are used for restraints, mm-hmm. and that's probably part of the stuff they want to be able to capture if it's not already being captured.
Right.
Maybe, because that might not be an incident report. So.
Yeah, that may not be an artificial, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, because we, Madam Chair, we did have an incident at Scar Jasper Mountain in Lane County with juvenile holds that were done improperly. It's a pretty big deal right now. Okay. There's a conversation going on about whether those types of holds were appropriate or not, and they're not, apparently.
Okay. Well, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mike Morris, DHS. Back.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I am Mike Morris, Mental Health Policy Manager with Department of Human Services, Addiction and Mental Health Services Division. And I'm here to just highlight some of the issues that have already been discussed, and one is that the bill needs to be further refined to narrow the implication and the scope of this bill to those receiving mental health services. And so that is one amendment that we've already discussed with Mr. Jundev. So the other is, as has also been brought up, there are a variety of reports regarding seclusion restraints from different levels of care. Kids residential programs have ways that they collect it and report information. So it's important that as we work on refinements of the bill is that we clarify and make sure that we're not duplicating efforts and working to coordinate all those efforts to get the information. The Department of Human Services is very interested in the reduction and elimination of seclusion restraint, and we really do support the collection of this data, and this this legislation would help us as we work with our providers to collect that information. There is one additional concern regarding public disclosure of information. The concern there is we have some facilities that are quite small, and that if we start sharing public information, there is a potential for the public to be able to identify individuals that are receiving psychiatric mental health treatment. And we've discussed this with Oregon Advocacy Center, and we think we can work to address that with changes in language in the bill. So those were the primary concerns that we have. We definitely are interested in collecting information and addressing issues of seclusion restraint. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, same thing as with the other bill. Why don't you go ahead and work? It sounds like you'll be able to work out something that improves the disclosure. And again, as with the other bill, if you could consider include Senator Cruz in the loop. Senator Cruz, did you have a comment?
Yeah, no question. When you're talking about disclosure of information, is that outside of HIPAA concerns or is it inside of HIPAA concerns? And are there HIPAA concerns here?
Senator Cruz, Chair Burdick, there are concerns regarding HIPAA and the implications of HIPAA, and we have to be very careful about information that could be traced to an individual person in sharing protective health information.
Okay.
Yes.
I thought when I was reading this, Madam Chair, I thought, you know, there may be some HIPAA issues here that will need to be addressed. So.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Thank Mitch. You. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 265, and that completes our agenda. I just wanted to remind the committee that tomorrow is our lunch with the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and we're going to have a couple of absentees, but it'll be joint with the House.
We're going to read support for Senator Walker's committee.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.